Get it done.
Revolution Radio, where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
I think of you as an inspiration in my radio career.
You must be some kind of a kook.
Thank you.
It's hard out here for a pimp.
All right, listen up, y'all.
You bunch of a-holes.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide?
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
Check your systems are offline.
Mario! I'll write it and we'll do it live!
What the hell's going on out here?
Ladies and gentlemen, you're ready. Because there's no one like you left.
Hashtag confused, dude.
What kind of feeling? I'm high on believing that you're in love with me.
I'm not good enough for life.
Good evening, Flips. I literally forgot to call the radio station. I'm just sitting here. I was just hanging out here on the computer, listening to Dr. Fetzer and Mitch and the rest of the folks. Just talking about the election, and all of a sudden, I think to myself, no, you probably call in. All right, kid. Happy pre-election day, or as I like to call it, pre-zombie apocalypse, or an everybody go completely bad shit. 503 Central, 603 East, 403 Mountain, 303 West Coast. Bit past 10 o'clock in Iceland, and good morning, Australia. Happy Tuesday morning. Happy Tuesday morning. Tuesday morning. I'm sorry. Happy Tuesday morning. Can you give us an update? Do you know what's going on? Now, you've seen the JFK movie, right? And there's that character played by Donald Sutherland. And he calls himself Mr. X. He's the dude that meets Kevin Costner somewhere in D.C. I think the Lincoln Memorial. Anyway, he talks about how he's over in Greenland or Iceland, or has a layover in Iceland or someplace, and how the time zone is, what, 5 or 6 hours ahead over there. And literally they have Lee Harvey Oswald sentenced, tried, and convicted before the news even reached here. That's what I feel that Australia has right now, is they've got all the information. Now, the reason why I seem slightly distracted is because the maintenance guy was here for the unit that I'm renting. And it's a well maintained but older duplex, so they had to drain the radiators. what's that term called when they let the air out? Air them out? Well, the cats brought me a little gift. They brought me a small little a little baby mouse. I thought, oh, thank you. So I decided to liberate the little guy because they were just playing with it. And the cats were declawed, so they were playing with it. There wasn't much going on. And then I was back in the room where the litter box is, and then I moved something, and sure enough, second little guy ran out. So I picked him up and brought him outside and had him hang out with his brother. And the folks that lived downstairs said that they caught two of them. Now, I think they were coming up from a small little there's a gas line cap off, which I think runs through the joist then down to the basement where the gas line comes in. And I think – or the water line rather. And I think that's how they were getting up. So I just put some tape over it. But the cats are sitting there ready to pounce. Ready to pounce on whatever comes up. And I'm man enough to admit, I'm not a big fan of snakes, bats, or mice. I know they're fairly harmless. But, yeah, I'm not a big fan. But Miss Pickles is back there just waiting. And Sylvester Charles is back there. So if you need a better reason to get a cat, mousers, kids. Mousers. Mousers are wonderful. So if I could suggest anything, get yourself a nice little mouser. Okay, let's play the game. Let's do my contribution to tomorrow's election. Wait, I'm sorry, tomorrow's election day. Let's not guarantee it'll be finished by tomorrow. I know everybody's giving their predictions, but my prediction is this. Bat shit craziness. Doesn't matter. It'll be batshit craziness tomorrow. I expect to wake up tomorrow morning. I will literally go the block and a half to vote. And I predict there will be craziness all day tomorrow. And I simply cannot wait. Here we go.
This is former Vice President Joe Biden. In 2008, his running mate Barack Obama ran on an inspiring message of hope and change. On the night of the final presidential debate of the 2020 cycle, Joe Biden also ran on a message of doom and gloom.
220,000 Americans dead. The expectation is we'll have another 200,000 Americans dead between now and the end of the year. And there's no prospect that there's going to be a vaccine available for the majority of the American people before the middle of next year. We're about to lose 200,000 more people. We're about to go into a dark winter. A dark winter.
Joe, you got to stop. Your optimism is just too overwhelming.
The expectation is we'll have another 200,000 Americans dead between now and the end of the year.
No, Joe is exaggerating. Bigly. The current expectation from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation is that between the debate and the end of the year, in a worst-case scenario, there would be an additional 109,000 more deaths, not 200,000 like Joe claims.
If we just wore these masks, the president's own advisors have told him, we could save 100,000 lives.
That's not true either. The IHME also estimates that if there were universal mask mandates, there would be, in a best-case scenario, an additional 48,000 deaths by the end of the year. So wearing masks wouldn't save 100,000 lives by the end of the year, like Joe claims.
The way this president has responded to this crisis has been absolutely tragic. And so, folks, I will take care of this. I will end this. I will make sure we have a plan.
You hear that, everyone? Joe Biden has a plan and is promising to end this. Let's hear his brilliant plan to prepare us for the dark winter of COVID.
What I would do is make sure we have everyone encouraged to wear a mask all the time. I would make sure we move in the direction of rapid testing.
Okay, encouraging everyone to wear a mask all the time is not a plan. And testing is improving thanks to the private sector. Regardless, you can have all the testing in the world, but people are still going to catch it. In other words, Biden and the Democrats do not have a plan to end COVID. Also, if Biden ends up winning the election, Trump will have set up the next administration pretty well. Operation Warp Speed, getting remdesivir approved as a treatment for emergency use, and enough ventilators to last the next 1,000 pandemics.
President Trump, your reaction? He says you have no plan.
I don't think we're going to have a dark winter at all. We're opening up our country. We've learned and studied and understand the disease, which we didn't at the beginning. When I closed and banned China from coming in heavily infected, and then ultimately Europe, but China was in January. Months later, he was saying I was xenophobic. I did it too soon. Now he's saying, oh, I should have, you know, moved quicker.
My response is he is xenophobic, but not because he shut down access from China.
And that's another lie. On March 18th, President Trump tweeted the following. I have always treated the Chinese virus very seriously and have done a very good job from the beginning, including my very early decision to close the borders from China against the wishes of almost all. Many lives were saved. 8 hours later, Joe Biden quote tweeted Trump and said, stop the xenophobic fear-mongering. The week before, Joe tweeted, a wall will not stop the coronavirus. Banning all travel from Europe or any part of the world will not stop it. No one was claiming that. Travel restrictions were designed to slow the spread, not stop it. Then Joe starts complaining that Trump initiated the travel restrictions late.
And he did it late after 40 countries had already done that.
According to the Washington Post, these 11 countries imposed travel bans between January 24th and January 30th. On January 31st, the United States announced its travel restrictions, the same day that these countries imposed their travel restrictions, including Italy, which was the only country in the G20 to do so at the time. So no, Trump was not late. Joe was lying. And if you think that Joe Biden would have closed the border, think again. In this January 27th op-ed piece in USA Today, Joe Biden references this tweet from then-US citizen Donald Trump, who called for President Obama to close down the flights from Ebola-infected areas. Biden claims that Trump was in favor of reactionary travel bans that would have only made things worse.
He thought I shouldn't have closed the border. Well, that's obvious.
So remember, folks, Biden was against the travel ban before he was for it.
And then what happened was we started talking about using the Defense Act to make sure we go out and get whatever is needed out there to protect people. And again, I go back to this. He had nothing. He did virtually nothing.
Virtually nothing? Trump invoked the Defense Production Act 78 times between March and September. And you don't want to overuse it anyway. Joe Biden cannot stop lying.
But guess what?
What is it this time, Joe?
In the meantime, we find out in the New York Times the other day that, in fact, his folks went to Wall Street and said this is a really dangerous thing. And a memo out of that meeting, not from his administration, but from some of the brokers, said sell short because we got to get moving.
Biden is referring to this New York Times article that tells the story of how President Trump was being a cheerleader for the economy on February 24th. The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA. Stock market starting to look very good to me. But hours earlier, senior members of the president's economic team privately addressing board members of the conservative Hoover Institution were less confident. Oh my God, they were less confident than the president? Tell me more, New York Times. Thomas J. Phillipson, a senior economic advisor to the president, told the group he could not yet estimate the effects of the virus on the American economy. So he wasn't sure how the virus would affect the economy? Oh no. Then Larry Kudlow, the director of the National Economic Council, asserted that the virus was contained in the US to date, but now we just don't know. To summon the group, the implication was that an outbreak could prove worse than Mr. Phillipson and other Trump administration advisors were signaling in public at the time. So according to the article, a hedge fund consultant who attended the briefings wrote a memo giving the following opinion. What struck me, the consultant wrote, was that nearly every official he heard from raised the virus as a point of concern, totally unprovoked. So this memo, which we haven't seen, so I guess we got to take the New York Times word for it, made the rounds to investors, and those investors supposedly interpreted what was in the memo to be a time to sell. And that's it, that's the whole story. But Joe Biden is saying that members of the Trump administration went to Wall Street and said,
this is a really dangerous thing.
But that's not remotely what the New York Times article says. The only dangerous thing here, Joe, is your willingness to mischaracterize and lie about everything that Trump says and does.
I do want to ask you, Vice President Biden, about China. President Trump has said that they should pay for not being fully transparent in regards to the coronavirus. If you were president, would you make China pay? And please be specific, what would that look like?
Now watch Joe Biden not answer a specific question.
What I'd make China do is play by the international rules. He has caused the deficit of China to go up, not down, with China, up, not down.
No. According to the U.S. Census, the goods and services trade deficit with China fell to $307.2 billion in 2019, and that's lower than Obama's last 3 years in office. That's down, not up, Joe.
When I met with Xi, when I was still vice president, he said we're setting up air identification zones in the South China Sea. You can't fly through them. I said we're going to fly through them. We just flew B-52, B-1 bombers through it. We're not going to pay attention. They have to play by the rules.
Except that every administration challenges China over their disputed airspace and maritime territory, so Biden acting like he's a tough guy is kind of funny.
And what's he do?
I don't know, Joe, what?
He embraces guys like the thugs like in North Korea and the Chinese president and Putin and others, and he pokes his finger in the eye of all of our friends, all of our allies.
I am so sick of Biden using this line. It's not true.
We make up we're 25% of the world's economy. We need to be having the rest of our friends with us saying to China, these are the rules. You play by them or you're going to pay the price for not paying by them economically.
Or we could just worry about policy that benefits the United States and let other countries deal with China themselves, you know, like Trump is already doing. So Biden didn't answer Welker's question, but as you'll see, neither did President Trump. And that's only because Biden's response forced Trump to defend his trade policy.
What specifically are you going to do to make China pay? You've said you're going
First
to make
of all,
them pay.
China is paying. They're paying billions and billions of dollars. I just gave $28 billion.
New sanctions?
I just gave $28 billion to our farmers.
Taxpayers'
China,
money.
It's what?
Taxpayers' money.
Didn't come from
China.
You know the taxpayers. It's called China.
Biden is full of it because he knows that that's not how tariffs work.
My response is, look, this isn't about – there's a reason why he's bringing up all this malarkey. There's a reason for it. He doesn't want to talk about the substantive issues.
Joe Biden is saying that international trade isn't a substantive issue. Got it.
If you're a middle-class family, you're getting hurt badly right now. You're sitting at the kitchen table this morning deciding, well, we can't get new tires, they're bald because we have to wait another month or so. Or are we going to be able to pay the mortgage? Or who's going to tell her she can't go back to community college? They're the decisions you're making in the middle-class families like I grew up in Scranton and Claymont.
I'm stopping you right there, Joe.
10 seconds, Mr. President.
That's a typical political statement. Let's get off this China thing. And then he looks, the family, around the table, everything. Just right. A typical politician when I see that.
Let's talk
I'm
about
not
North
a typical
Korea.
Politician.
Okay,
that's
President.
Why I got elected. That
let's
was,
talk
let's
about-
get off the subject of China. Let's talk around sitting around the table.
All right.
Come on, Joe, you can do better.
No, President Trump. Joe, in fact, can't do better. You're giving him way too much credit. Next, during the segment about race and criminal justice reform, Biden tried to put President Trump in a negative light.
Look, and talk about he, granted, he did in fact let 20 people, he commuted 20 people's sentences. We commuted over 1,000 people's sentences. Over 1,000.
Let's look at some stats. So far, during his first term, President Trump issued 27 pardons and 11 commutations. During President Obama's first term, 22 were pardoned and one person was granted clemency. And that means Trump pardoned and granted clemency to more people in his first term than Obama did in his. Nice try, Joe.
And secondly, we're in a situation here where the federal prison system was reduced by 38,000 people under our administration.
Wrong. At the beginning of President Obama's first term, the federal prison population was 201,280. At the end of 2016, it was 189,192, which means the federal prison population was reduced by 12,088, not 38,000. So Biden was off by nearly 26,000, whatever.
Let me give you a chance to respond within this context. Crime bills that you supported in the 80s and 90s contributed to the incarceration of tens of thousands of young black men who had small amounts of drugs in their possession. So speak to those families. Why should they vote for you?
One of the things is that in the 80s, we passed 100%, all 100 senators voted for it, a bill on drugs and how to deal with drugs. It was a mistake. I've been trying to change it since then, particularly the portion on cocaine.
Biden is referring to a 1986 anti-drug law, which Biden co-authored, that included a sentencing disparity between offenses for crack cocaine and powdered cocaine by a 100-to-1 ratio.
We have to hold every drug user accountable, because if there were no drug users, there would be no appetite for drugs, and there'd be no market for them.
And since the crack epidemic mostly affected African-American communities, harsher sentencing for crack offenses added to so-called mass incarceration. So Biden tried to take the focus off the fact that he was tough on crime and pointed to alleged past quotes of Donald Trump.
This is a guy who said, the problem with the crime bill, there's not enough people in jail. There's not enough people in jail. And go on my website, get the quote, the date when he said it. Not enough people.
Except Biden never put this up on his website, because Trump never said it. Another lie, I know you're shocked. In reality, he wasn't talking about Trump. Joe Biden was talking about Joe Biden.
He talked about marauding gangs, young gangs, and the people who are going to maraud our cities.
But the violence associated with drugs is spewing out all over America, and that's terrible. Violent drug offenders will commit more than 100,000 crimes on this day alone.
This is a guy who said, the problem with the crime bill, there's not enough people in jail.
In a nutshell, the president's plan doesn't include enough police officers to catch the violent thugs, not enough prosecutors to convict them, not enough judges to sentence them, and not enough prison cells to put them away for a long time.
When you accuse others of doing things that you're in fact guilty of, that's called projection, Joe.
That's what we've been trying to do. That's what I'm going to get done, because I think maybe the American people have now seen that, in fact, it was a mistake to pass those laws relating to drugs.
And that statement set up what was, in my opinion, President Trump's best moment during the debate.
It's all talk, no action with these politicians. Why didn't he get it done? That's what I'm going to do when I become president. You were vice president, along with Obama as your president, your leader, for 8 years. Why didn't you get it done? You had 8 years to get it done. Now you're saying you're going to get it done because you're all talk and no action, Jim.
We got a lot of it done. We released 38,000 prisoners left from the...
You got nothing done.
38,000 prisoners were released from federal prison.
Nope.
Why didn't you do it in the 8 years, a short time ago? Why didn't you do it? You just said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this. You put tens of thousands of mostly black young men in prison. Now you're saying you're going to undo that.
What President Trump is failing to understand here is that Joe Biden, having served 36 years in the Senate and 8 years as vice president, is finally going to make up for all of his past mistakes made during his 36 years in the Senate and 8 years as vice president.
Why didn't you get it done? You had 8 years with Obama. You know why, Joe? Because you're all talk and no action.
All right, Vice President Biden, and then we're going to move on to the next section.
We had a Republican Congress. That's the answer.
No, it's not. During President Obama's first 2 years in office, the Democrats had a majority in the House and a supermajority in the Senate. That's how they were able to push through Obamacare. Of course, Obamacare is the key reason why Democrats lost the House and the Senate, but for the sake of argument, let's pretend that a Republican Congress did in fact stop him from getting simple criminal justice reform passed. If that's the case, then how does he expect to be able to get Biden care passed?
But can't say it enough. This guy, when I say this guy, I'm talking about President Trump, is such a good friend and such a loyal, amazing guy, man. He's a great guy. He's been a friend of mine for a long time, and you know,
you're not worried about losing any viewers for, you know, over your friendship with the president.
I could give
right
there. You go, folks. Tomorrow I'll be going to my polling place, roughly a block. What direction is that? North. And then turn and go a block and a half west. to the church, and I'll be voting. I'll be voting for Donald J. Trump. And if you're not, well, as I chew on my carrot rudely on the air, you do you, man. You do you. Apparently, I'm going to apologize. I think field mice and house mice are synonymous, but apparently they are not. Now, barns. What kind of mice go in barns? Are those field mice? I honestly thought field mice house mice are the same. But apparently I'm wrong. So, which is fine. I mean, you know, I'm man enough to say I get the species confused. Rats are dangerous. My dad tells a story when he was younger that he and his buddies used to go downtown to, I don't know, some garbage joint. And they used to they take their 22s and go hunt rats. And I thought, those things are going to bite you and you're going to get something. And you can't just go swim in the Jersey River either and get rid of it. I believe this is my fourth carrot today. No. Yo, maybe it is. No, third. Third, but they're somewhat... How many carrots can you eat in a day? I normally have four. Is that too many or too few? I don't know. All right. Here comes the bottom of the hour news break. Right, commercial break. I'm sorry. But it's a news break. Coming at the bottom of the hour. And we'll be back, and maybe we can... I can finally get an answer to the differences between field mice and house mice, or I can just use the internets. All right, folks. I always want to say folks. My tongue moves faster than my mouth sometimes. That sounds a little sassy. Just like gerrymandering. Doesn't gerrymandering sound like a sexual position? It does to me. But then again, I'm that guy. Here's the music.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The blood is filling with adrenaline, Radnor. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
All right, folks, welcome back. My name is Mario. This is This, That, and the Other, heard every Monday and Thursday here on Revolution Radio, conveniently located at revolution.radio across any of the interwebs. So, unbeknownst to me, apparently there are Three main species of mice, three common, considered to be major pests in the country. You've got the deer or field mouse, you've got the annoying house mouse, and you have the white-footed mouse. Now, the deer mouse, also known as the field mouse, are pests that prefer to live in wooded areas. They will, however, venture into homes, sheds, and outbuildings located in or around wooded areas. They can be destructive to wood structures as well as carrying with them a number of potential health concerns. Now, the tail is usually bicolored and very long, longer than half the length of the body and covered with short hair. The life cycle, they hit sexual maturity in about 7 to 8 weeks, and they normally live, between 2 and 20 and 14 months, well, because, you know, predators and stuff. However, some in captivity have lived between 5 and 8 years. They're nocturnal, come out at night, they're excellent climbers, will be found even in upper levels of structures like in attics and upper floors. Cold months here in Minnesota, they'll enter buildings. Oh, one of the leading carriers of hantavirus, which can be very dangerous to humans. Wasn't that exciting? Now, the house mouse, 4 to 16 young per litter, 7 to 8 litters a year. Wow. Usually ground living and burrowing, but often climb, prefer food, is cereal. Eat around an ounce of food. Not an ounce of food, 0.1 ounce of food a day, and can survive without any additional water. They will drink up to 0.1 fluid ounces a day if their diet is particularly dry. Small feet and head and large eyes and ears distinguish them from a young brown rat. Oh. Then finally, the white-footed mouse can be found in eastern U.S. from mid-Maine south to North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, west to Montana, Colorado, and Arizona. It's a relatively small rodent with a combined head and body measurement of just 3.5 to 4 inches. Their feet are white, and so is the belly. Upper part of their body is grayish to reddish-brown, and the tail is the same two colors. Huh! So if you got problems with any of these mice, how to deter them? Well, probably keep your house clean and get a cat. Get a cat. So deny them access, go outside, make sure you got all the holes plugged up. What else? They're good climbers. Able to scale rough vertical surfaces and walk along thin cables or wires. They have soft skeletons and can get through gaps the width of a pencil. Huh. Keep your food covered. Use those bristle strips at the bottom of your door. Seal holes. If you've got air bricks and vents, you should cover those with fine galvanized wire mesh, especially if they are damaged. Fix damaged roofing with wire mesh to seal gaps. Trim back branches and such around your house. And keep your grass short. And get a cat. Get a cat. That's what I would do. Get yourself a cat. Now, I think things are back to normal here at the house. I say that because Sylvester Charles came over and meowed, and normally that's because he wants a pet. Now he's walking around. He seems fine. Just for an update for you folks, Miss Pickles is now still staring at the hole I covered. Again, it looked like a I think it's a water line cap off. So they may have climbed up there, and that's how the two little ones got in. But there could still be more. The night isn't over. There could still be more, and I will keep you folks updated on the mice situation, because I'm not afraid to say I hate mice. I there is nothing about a mouse that I like at all. I think they're disgusting, but they are what they are. All right, folks, let's go take some time and visit our friends over at Bedtime Stories.
In an isolated rural corner of South Carolina, there is an area of swampland that has come to gain no small amount of notoriety. Is this inhospitable region home to one of North America's most infamous cryptids? Join us as we delve into the secret of Skapor Swamp. On a cold midweek morning in February of 2008, Bob Rawson whispered goodbye to his sleeping wife, Dixie, before slipping out of his front door to go to work. It was still dark as he crossed the open ground between the farmhouse and the spot where the family truck was parked, but as he neared his vehicle, his hand ferreting in a cavernous jacket pocket for his keys, he caught sight of something which caused him to take a sharp intake of breath. The switchboard operator for the Lee County Sheriff's Department had struggled to understand the content of the panicked phone call she had subsequently received from Mr. Rawson. He needed help urgently, as a crime had been committed. No, nobody had been hurt, and no, he didn't know who was responsible. But he and his family were not safe, and they needed police protection immediately. The two deputies who were dispatched to the Rawson farmstead were intercepted by the homeowner well before they had chance to turn off the main highway and onto the road leading up to his property. Torches in hand, they had followed closely behind as he had half run to where his truck was situated, gesticulating in an animated fashion at the front of the parked vehicle. In the dim torchlight, they could see that extensive damage had been caused to the vehicle's exterior. But it was only when they looked more closely that they realized why Rawson was so agitated. Parts of the front wheel arches on both sides of the truck had been twisted and bent outwards, so they now jutted out at right angles from the main chassis. The surface of these damaged strips of metal was scratched and covered with indentations, almost as if they had been chewed upon. Damage of a similar nature was to be found on the vehicle's front grille, where in places, the metal had been pierced right through, as if bitten by a wild animal of some kind. Struggling to come up with a satisfactory hypothesis, the two officers had called for a crime scene examiner, in a bid to identify who or what was responsible. Samples taken from the damaged metalwork were sent off for analysis, and a week later, it was confirmed that canine DNA had been recovered from the swabs. But when detectives reattended to share this information, Rawson had merely shaken his head in disbelief. Without speaking a word, he had led the officers across his property to a field in which the bodies of a number of dead animals lay. In addition to the remains of several domesticated cats, there were a number of dead cow carcasses and a corpse of a recently departed coyote. In calm and clear terms, Mr. Rawson explained that the DNA the analysts had found most likely belonged to the coyote, but it had come from the mouth of whatever had killed and eaten the animal before subsequently attacking his truck. The Rawson farm was being stalked by an unseen attacker, one which resided in the neighboring swamp and had been haunting the area for over 20 years. The cities of Sumter and Bishopsville are as indistinct as any other found dotted around the rural reaches of South Carolina. Indeed, were it not for the region of dense swampland which separates them, these two communities may well have remained in quiet anonymity, with no reason whatsoever to invite the attention of the national press. But even from the day that this inhospitable patch of land was first named, it has flirted with notoriety. What most local historians agree upon is that Scapehaw Swamp earned its title from the phrase "escaped whore swamp," in reference to a long-past incident involving a local female of ill repute. It is here, though, that the disagreements begin, as it appears that the region possesses more than its fair share of stories involving ladies of the night. One tale has the woman in question being driven out of a nearby town by the angry wives of her clients. Another, more colourful version is believed to have occurred during the Revolutionary War, when a group of local militiamen surprised an encampment of British soldiers who were entertaining some of the local prostitutes. Having captured their opponents, the revolutionaries then drove the women away and deeper into the marshland. But the incident which would truly propel Scapehaw Swamp into the national consciousness would occur many years later, in the early hours of the 29th of June, 1988. At approximately 2 o'clock that morning, a local youth by the name of Christopher Davis was driving home from his shift at a nearby diner when his car sustained a flat tire. Davis coasted the vehicle to a spot just off the main road and immediately set about changing the tire in question. The highway had been quiet, with no other vehicles passing by. He had just deposited the damaged tire in the boot of his car and was wiping the dirt from his hands when there was a rustling sound in the bushes behind him. When he turned around to look, there was nobody there. But as he closed the boot lid of his car, he heard the rustling sound again. Attempting to stifle a growing feeling of apprehension, Davis slowly walked back to the passenger side door and retrieved a torch from the glove box. Switching it on, he directed the beam into the bushes where the noise had emanated from, but there was nothing to be seen. As he took a step backwards away from the foliage, lowering the torch so that the light was now pointing towards the ground, a huge dark shape suddenly emerged from the brush. Davis instinctively raised the torch again to illuminate the figure before immediately dropping it to the ground and crying out in terror. Bolting over to the driver's side door, the terrified teen frantically fumbled for the door handle, his mind utterly traumatized by what he had just seen. The creature that had been advancing towards him was between 6 and 7 feet tall, dark green in color, with water glistening and dripping from the scales that covered its naked body. He leapt into the driver's seat and immediately gunned the ignition, only for the car to be rocked from side to side by a violent impact. With a sickening feeling, Davis glanced in his mirror to see a ghoulish face leering back at him through the car's rear window. A pair of menacing red eyes regarded him, which almost seemed to glow when the moonlight caught them, whilst a mouth full of misshapen teeth opened and closed beneath them. The teen let out another cry, flooring the pedal and sending the car hurtling back up onto the highway. Over the roar of the engine, he heard several loud bangs, and then a scrabbling noise on the roof of the car directly above him, before another heavy impact shook the vehicle. Panicking, he slammed down hard on the brakes and watched in disbelief as a huge shape was immediately thrown onto the road in front of him. In the intense beams of the car headlights, he could see that the creature was broad and muscular, with three taloned claws at the end of each of its hands. For a moment, it lay motionless, before its head suddenly snapped to the side, staring back at him. In a heartbeat, Davis again floored the accelerator, the car shooting off down the highway and leaving the creature lying where it fell. Several days later, when the teenager learned that the local sheriff's office was investigating a report in Browntown of a parked car having been attacked by a mysterious creature, he called the police. Deputies attended his home address, photographing the deep scratch marks on the boot and roof of his vehicle, as well as a missing wing mirror, before asking him to take them back to the scene of the encounter. Davis showed the officers the tire marks which demonstrated where he had braked hard to dislodge the creature from his roof, before leading them onto the bushes from where it had first emerged. Strange tracks were discovered in the thick mud just inside the tree line, and so plaster casts were taken and sent off to the South Carolina Marine Resources Department for analysis. A few days later, Sheriff Liston Truesdale received a phone call from a Dr. Evans, informing him that the casts had been of a large foot with three clawed toes, and that they did not match anything that the department kept on file. As the weeks progressed, there would be further overnight attacks on vehicles, with deep gouges and bite marks found by their owners the following morning. These incidents, as well as further sightings of a large lizard-like creature, would intensify during the following month, all centered on a five-mile patch of swampland on the outskirts of Bishopsville. Then, on August the 5th, an off-duty airman reported that he had shot and wounded a creature that had attacked him on Highway 15. Since then, there have only been sporadic sightings of the Skapor Lizard Man, but these have stubbornly persisted up until the present day. As beguiling as the tale is of a lizard man emerging from his swamp to spend his evenings chasing passing motorists before attacking their vehicles, the Skapor story is not without its flaws. And one of the greatest undermining factors of the tale is the testimony of Kenneth Orr, the man who was alleged to have injured the beast in the weeks following the original Christopher Davis encounter. When the airman contacted police to report his actions, he also handed over what appeared to be blood and tissue samples he had recovered from the scene of the incident. 2 days later, Orr found himself being arrested for illegal possession of a firearm and making a false report to the police. When he subsequently appeared at trial, he stated to the court that he had fabricated the entire incident for attention. No records of the tissue analysis he had provided, or the reasons for his sudden change of heart, have ever been revealed, prompting suspicions about the integrity of the police investigation. Perhaps curiously, however, the Skapor Swamp Monster is only one of a colourful gallery of reptilian monsters who are alleged to haunt the highways and byways of the United States. Indeed, it appears that the Sasquatches, which apparently saturate the North American continent, have a significant amount of cold-blooded competition. During the 1950s, the city of Loveland, Ohio, was plagued by sightings of oversized aquatic monsters. Motorists reported that whilst driving at night, they had seen what they described as tall, frog-like entities either crossing the main highways ahead of them or fleeing into the safety of the nearby bodies of water. Over time, these entities became known as the Loveland Frogs, with reports concerning the creatures continuing until the spring of 1972. Following a fresh wave of nocturnal sightings, police officers shot and killed a 4-foot-long iguana, which was believed to have escaped from a local collector. With this animal's death, sightings of the Loveland Frog also quickly ceased. Several months later, two youths who were fishing on the shores of a lake in British Columbia reported seeing a scaly creature which had sharp claws and spikes on its head swimming through the nearby waters. When further witnesses to the incident also later came forward, the legend of the Thetis Lake Monster was born. However, much like the Skapor Lizard Man and Loveland Frogs before it, this new creature ended up being dismissed as the product of overactive imaginations. Investigators were quick to point out that the description of the Canadian cryptid was strikingly similar to the creature featured in the movie Monster from the Surf, which had been screened on local television only 4 days before. Returning to the dark and foreboding depths of Skapor Swamp, the authorities maintain that the creature which was encountered is likely to be either an alligator or a large monitor lizard. In poor weather or lighting, and under severe levels of stress, they propose that witnesses have misidentified everyday creatures, believing that they were standing upright on two legs when they were more likely either clambering or rearing up in an aggressive manner. The damage to motor vehicles has been laid at the door of coyotes and bears, or even attributed to human offenders. Much as it was alleged that pranksters have sought to cash in on the famed Mothman sightings in West Virginia during the 1960s, there are suggestions that local residents have manufactured sightings of the Lizard Man in order to increase tourism in the region. And yet, with still further sightings having been reported since the attacks on the Rawson household in 2008, perception seemed to be slowly moving away from a rational explanation towards one that is far more speculative in nature. Some experts continue to draw parallels between the mysterious tracks recovered by local deputies and monsters from a far bygone age. Dr. Rudy Mankey, a naturalist from the University of South Carolina, believes it is entirely possible that if the Skapor cryptid does indeed exist, it may be descended from some form of bipedal dinosaur. Historically, some tall birds such as emus and ostriches once possessed scales and a thick hide, as opposed to their more feathery descendants. Could this be where the three-toed animal tracks have really originated from? As the technology we carry on our person continues to evolve at a startling rate, it seems highly likely that the secrets of Skapor Swamp will not manage to remain an enigma for much longer. Be this one of the most successful hoaxes in American history, or a true evolutionary wonder waiting to be uncovered, it is inevitable that at some future point, the mystery of the Lizard Man must be solved, once and for all.
You know, first of all, it always amazes me that with today's technology, everybody's photo is grainy. And secondly, I'm a little distracted because every time the cat jumps up, or one of the cats jump up on the desk here, I'm expecting them to bring me a mouse gift. I don't know. It is what it is, kids. All right, this is Revolution Radio, conveniently located at revolution.radio on any of the interwebs. I've completely forgot to do this, so I apologize, but to the 33 people of you online, thank you. 45 have visited the room in the last 24 hours. In total, there are 364 visitors. On this list, I will not read all of them. But of the 364, we do have 7 admins, 5 moderators. Who are the moderators? 177 are trusted. 154 are allowed, 2 are banned, and 19 are blocked for being just complete morons. And it looks like the same person. What do you have to do to get banned from this channel? I mean, you've got to be a real tool, as they say. A real tool. DeGrog and Comet and Boy Solomon, Navy, Meow Meow, Wild Bob, as known as WB, I believe. Saul, Rudolph, hello, an old guy, Troy boy, dry fly guy, okay. Jimmy Jean, Mario, that's me. Pat Rabbit, my favorite chatter. Train, Lusitania, still afloat, Eagle Flower, Monster 383, which equals 14. Actually, I'm sorry, it equals 14. Stardust Man, Noreen, Colin Valerie. Is that the song Valerie? No. Is it Valerie? I don't know. Nice guy, not much to it. Dirt Engineer, Jer Bear, number two. How are you doing, Jer Bear? Haven't heard you in a while. How are things going over there in your neck of the woods?
Wow, what? Wow, what? How you doing? What's your daddy doing? What's your mama doing? How you doing? Wow.
Well, I'm doing fine, Jer. Thanks for asking. I hope you are doing well also. In the kitchen, May Street 139, Batsman, my favorite host, Mr. Roa Mega Logo, Surrey Sunflower, the gale across the big water hole, Festus B, and Popsicle Toes. Hello to all of you. We are soon approaching the top of the hour break. Other side of the hour, we're going to listen to, I don't know, I Like It. I like it a lot. It's a little speech by old Ronnie Reagan titled Time for Choosing. Here comes the music. Talk with you folks shortly.
To act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of
more... Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, stupidity.
I'll do you for that. What? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Revolution, Revolution Radio.
You don't see it, do you? How close we are to absolute chaos. The sick ones are sitting on their fat asses, eating and drinking themselves into a stupor, polluting the world without a second thought while it goes down the toilet. Nobody wants to do the nasty work. You know, the shit that we all just think about. Most good citizens are just along for the ride and then bitch and moan and complain about everything when it doesn't work out. Not me. Get it done.
Revolution Radio, where we do the nasty work. www.freedomslips.com.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Ladies and gentlemen, we take pride in presenting A Thoughtful Address by Ronald Reagan. Mr. Reagan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you and good evening. The sponsor has been identified, but unlike most television programs, the performer hasn't been provided with a script. As a matter of fact, I have been permitted to choose my own words and discuss my own ideas regarding the choice that we face in the next few weeks. I have spent most of my life as a Democrat. I recently have seen fit to follow another course. I believe that the issues confronting us cross party lines. Now, one side in this campaign has been telling us that the issues of this election are the maintenance of peace and prosperity. The line has been used, we've never had it so good. But I have an uncomfortable feeling that this prosperity isn't something on which we can base our hopes for the future. No nation in history has ever survived a tax burden that reached a third of its national income. Today, 37 cents out of every dollar earned in this country is the tax collector's share. And yet our government continues to spend $17 million a day more than the government takes in. We haven't balanced our budget 28 out of the last 34 years. We've raised our debt limit 3 times in the last 12 months. And now our national debt is 1.5 times bigger than all the combined debts of all the nations of the world. We have $15 billion in gold in our treasury. We don't own an ounce. Foreign dollar claims are $27.3 billion. And we've just had announced that the dollar of 1939 will now purchase 45 cents. In its total value. As for the peace that we would preserve, I wonder who among us would like to approach the wife or mother whose husband or son has died in South Vietnam and ask them if they think this is a peace that should be maintained indefinitely. Do they mean peace, or do they mean we just want to be left in peace? There can be no real peace while one American is dying someplace in the world for the rest of us. We're at war with the most dangerous enemy that has ever faced mankind in his long climb from the swamp to the stars. And it's been said if we lose that war, and in so doing lose this way of freedom of ours, history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Well, I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the founding fathers. Not too long ago, two friends of mine were talking to a Cuban refugee, a businessman who had escaped from Castro. And in the midst of his story, one of my friends turned to the other and said, "We don't know how lucky we are." And the Cuban stopped and said, "How lucky you are. I had some place to escape to." And in that sentence, he told us the entire story. If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth. And this idea that government is beholden to the people, that it has no other source of power except the sovereign people, is still the newest and the most unique idea in all the long history of man's relation to man. This is the issue of this election. Whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. You and I are told increasingly we have to choose between a left or right. Well, I'd like to suggest there is no such thing as a left or right. There's only an up or down. Man's old age dream, the ultimate in individual freedom consistent with law and order, or down to the ant heap of totalitarianism. And regardless of their sincerity, their humanitarian motives, those who would trade our freedom for security have embarked on this downward course. In this vote harvesting time, they use terms like the Great Society, or, as we were told a few days ago by the president, we must accept a greater government activity in the affairs of the people. But they've been a little more explicit in the past, and among themselves, and all of the things I now will quote have appeared in print, These are not Republican accusations. For example, they have voices that say the Cold War will end through our acceptance of a not undemocratic socialism. Another voice says the profit motive has become outmoded. It must be replaced by the incentives of the welfare state. Or our traditional system of individual freedom is incapable of solving the complex problems of the 20th century. Senator Fulbright has said at Stanford University that the Constitution is outmoded. He referred to the president as our moral teacher and our leader. And he says he is hobbled in his task by the restrictions of power imposed on him by this antiquated document. He must be freed so that he can do for us what he knows is best. And Senator Clark of Pennsylvania, another articulate spokesman, defines liberalism as meeting the material needs of the masses through the full power of centralized government. Well, I, for one, resent it when a representative of the people refers to you and me, the free men and women of this country, as the masses. This is a term we haven't applied to ourselves in America. But beyond that, the full power of centralized government, this was the very thing the Founding Fathers sought to minimize. They knew that governments don't control things. A government can't control the economy without controlling people. And they know when a government sets out to do that, it must use force and coercion to achieve its purpose. They also knew, those founding fathers, that outside of its legitimate functions, government does nothing as well or as economically as the private sector of the economy. Now, we have no better example of this than government's involvement in the farm economy over the last 30 years. Since 1955, the cost of this program has nearly doubled. One-fourth of farming in America is responsible for 85% of the farm surplus. Three-fourths of farming is out on the free market and has known a 21% increase in the per capita consumption of all its produce. You see, that one-fourth of farming, that's regulated and controlled by the federal government. In the last 3 years, we've spent $43 in the feed grain program for every dollar bushel of corn we don't grow. Senator Humphrey last week charged that Barry Goldwater, as president, would seek to eliminate farmers. He should do his homework a little better, because he'll find out that we've had a decline of 5 million in the farm population under these government programs. He'll also find that the Democratic administration has sought to get from Congress extension of the farm program to include that three-fourths that is now free. He'll find that they've also asked for the right to imprison farmers who wouldn't keep books as prescribed by the federal government. The Secretary of Agriculture asked for the right to seize farms through condemnation and resell them to other individuals. And contained in that same program was a provision that would have allowed the federal government to remove 2 million farmers from the soil. At the same time, there's been an increase in the Department of Agriculture employees. There's now one for every 30 farms in the United States. And still, they can't tell us how 66 shiploads of grain headed for Austria disappeared without a trace, and Billy Solestis never left shore. Every responsible farmer and farm organization has repeatedly asked the government to free the farm economy. But who are farmers to know what's best for them? The wheat farmers voted against a wheat program. The government passed it anyway. Now the price of bread goes up, the price of wheat to the farmer goes down. Meanwhile, back in the city, under urban renewal, the assault on freedom carries on. Private property rights so diluted that public interest is almost anything a few government planners decide it should be. In a program that takes from the needy and gives to the greedy, we see such spectacles as in Cleveland, Ohio. $1.5 million building completed only 3 years ago must be destroyed to make way for what government officials call a more compatible use of the land. The president tells us he's now going to start building public housing units in the thousands, where heretofore we've only built them in the hundreds. But FHA and the Veterans Administration tell us they have 120,000 housing units they've taken back through mortgage foreclosure. For three decades, we've sought to solve the problems of unemployment through government planning, and the more the plans fail, the more the planners plan. The latest is the Area Redevelopment Agency. They've just declared Rice County, Kansas, a depressed area. Rice County, Kansas, has 200 oil wells, and the 14,000 people there have over $30 million on deposit in personal savings in their banks. A When the government tells you you're depressed, lie down and be depressed. We have so many people who can't see a fat man standing beside a thin one without coming to the conclusion the fat man got that way by taking advantage of the thin one. So they're going to solve all the problems of human misery through government and government planning. Well, now, if government planning and welfare had the answer, and they've had almost 30 years of it, shouldn't we expect government to read the score to us once in a while? Shouldn't they be telling us about the decline each year in the number of people needing help, the reduction in the need for public housing? But the reverse is true. Each year, the need grows greater. The program grows greater. We were told 4 years ago that 17 million people went to bed hungry each night. Well, that was probably true. They were all on a diet. But now we're told that 9.3 million families in this country are poverty-stricken on the basis of earning less than $3,000 a year. Welfare spending 10 times greater than it was in the dark depths of the Depression. We're spending $45 billion on welfare. Now, do a little arithmetic, and you'll find that if we divided the $45 billion up equally among those 9 million poor families, we'd be able to give each family $4,600 a year. And this, added to their present income, should eliminate poverty. Direct aid to the poor, however, is only running about $600 per family. It would seem that someplace there must be some overhead. So now we declare war on poverty, or you too can be a Bobby Baker. Now, do they honestly expect us to believe that if we add $1 billion to the $45 billion we're spending, one more program to the 30-odd we have, and remember this new program doesn't replace any, it just duplicates existing programs, do they believe that poverty is suddenly going to disappear by magic? Well, in all fairness, I should explain there is one part of the new program that isn't duplicated. This is the youth feature. We're now going to solve the dropout problem, juvenile delinquency, by reinstituting something like the old CCC camps. And we're going to put our young people in these camps. But again, we do some arithmetic and we find that we're going to spend each year just on room and board for each young person we help, $4,700 a year. We can send them to Harvard for $2,700. Of course, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting Harvard is the answer to juvenile delinquency. But seriously, what are we doing to those we seek to help? Not too long ago, a judge called me here in Los Angeles. He told me that a young woman who'd come before him for a divorce. She had 6 children, was pregnant with her 7th. Under his questioning, she revealed her husband was a laborer earning $250 a month. She wanted the divorce to get an $80 raise. She's eligible for $330 a month in the Aid to Dependent Children program. She got the idea from 2 women in her neighborhood who'd already done that very thing. Yet any time you and I question the schemes of the do-gooders, we're denounced as being against their humanitarian goals. They say we're always against things, we're never for anything. Well, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant, it's just that they know so much that isn't so. Now, we're for a provision that destitution should not follow unemployment by reason of old age. And to that end, we've accepted Social Security as a step toward meeting the problem. But we're against those entrusted with this program when they practice deception regarding its fiscal shortcomings, when they charge that any criticism of the program means that we want to end payments to those people who depend on them for a livelihood. They've called it insurance to us in 100 million pieces of literature. But then they appeared before the Supreme Court and they testified it was a welfare program. They only used the term insurance to sell it to the people. And they said Social Security dues are a tax for the general use of the government. And the government has used that tax. There is no fund. Because Robert Byers, the actuarial head, appeared before a congressional committee and admitted that Social Security, as of this moment, is $298 billion in the hole. But he said there should be no cause for worry, because as long as they had the power to tax, they could always take away from the people whatever they needed to bail them out of trouble. And they're doing just that. a young man 21 years of age, working at an average salary. His Social Security contribution would, in the open market, buy him an insurance policy that would guarantee $220 a month at age 65. The government promises $127. He could live it up until he's 31 and then take out a policy that would pay more than Social Security. Now, are we so lacking in business sense that we can't put this program on a sound basis so that people who do require those payments will find they can get them when they're due, that the cupboard isn't bare? Barry Goldwater thinks we can. At the same time, can't we introduce voluntary features that would permit a citizen who can do better on his own to be excused upon presentation of evidence that he had made provision for the non-earning years? Should we not allow a widow with children to work and not lose the benefits supposedly paid for by her deceased husband? Shouldn't you and I be allowed to declare who our beneficiaries will be under this program, which we cannot do? I think we're for telling our senior citizens that no one in this country should be denied medical care because of a lack of funds. But I think we're against forcing all citizens, regardless of need, into a compulsory government program, especially when we have such examples as was announced last week when France admitted that their Medicare program is now bankrupt. They've come to the end of the road. In addition, was Barry Goldwater so irresponsible when he suggested that our government give up its program of deliberate planned inflation, so that when you do get your Social Security pension, a dollar will buy a dollar's worth and not 45 cents worth? I think we're for an international organization where the nations of the world can seek peace. But I think we're against subordinating American interests to an organization that has become so structurally unsound that today you can muster a two-thirds vote on the floor of the General Assembly among nations that represent less than 10% of the world's population. I think we're against the hypocrisy of assailing our allies because here and there they cling to a colony, while we engage in a conspiracy of silence and never open our mouths about the millions of people enslaved in the Soviet colonies in the satellite nations. I think we're foraging our allies by sharing of our material blessings with those nations which share in our fundamental beliefs. But we're against doling out money government to government, creating bureaucracy, if not socialism, all over the world. We set out to help 19 countries. We're helping 107. We've spent $146 billion. With that money, we bought a $2 million yacht for Haile Selassie. We bought dress suits for Greek undertakers, extra wives for Kenya government officials. We bought 1,000 TV sets for a place where they have no electricity. In the last 6 years, 52 nations have bought $7 billion worth of our gold, and all 52 are receiving foreign aid from this country. No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size, so government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. Federal employees, number 2.5 million. And federal, state, and local, 1 out of 6 of the nation's workforce employed by government. These proliferating bureaus with their thousands of regulations have cost us many of our constitutional safeguards. How many of us realize that today federal agents can invade a man's property without a warrant? They can impose a fine without a formal hearing, let alone a trial by jury. And they can seize and sell his property at auction to enforce the payment of that fine. In Chico County, Arkansas, James Weir overplanted his rice allotment. The government obtained a $17,000 judgment, and a U.S. Marshal sold his 960-acre farm at auction. The government said it was necessary as a warning to others to make the system work. Last February 19th at the University of Minnesota, Norman Thomas, 6 times candidate for president on the Socialist Party ticket, said if Barry Goldwater became president, he would stop the advance of socialism in the United States. I think that's exactly what he will do. But as a former Democrat, I can tell you Norman Thomas isn't the only man who has drawn this parallel to socialism with the present administration. Because back in 1936, Mr. Democrat himself, Al Smith, the great American, came before the American people and charged that the leadership of his party was taking the party of Jefferson, Jackson, and Cleveland down the road under the banners of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin. And he walked away from his party and he never returned till the day he died. Because to this day, the leadership of that party has been taking that party, that honorable party, down the road in the image of the Labor Socialist Party of England. Now, it doesn't require expropriation or confiscation of private property or business to impose socialism on a people. What does it mean whether you hold the deed to the or the title to your business or property if the government holds the power of life and death over that business or property? And such machinery already exists. The government can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. Every businessman has his own tale of harassment. Somewhere a perversion has taken place. Our natural, unalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government. And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment. Our Democratic opponents seem unwilling to debate these issues. They want to make you and I believe that this is a contest between two men, that we're to choose just between two personalities. Well, what of this man that they would destroy? And in destroying, they would destroy that which he represents, the ideas that you and I hold dear. Is he the brash and shallow and trigger-happy man they say he is? Well, I've been privileged to know him when. I knew him long before he ever dreamed of trying for high office. And I can tell you personally, I've never known a man in my life I believed so incapable of doing a dishonest or dishonorable thing. This is a man who, in his own business, before he entered politics, instituted a profit-sharing plan before unions had ever thought of it. He put in health and medical insurance for all his employees. He took 50% of the profits before taxes and set up a retirement program, a pension plan for all his employees. He sent monthly checks for life to an employee who was ill and couldn't work. He provides nursing care for the children of mothers who work in the stores. When Mexico was ravaged by the floods in the Rio Grande, he climbed in his airplane and flew medicine and supplies down there. An ex-GI told me how he met him. It was the week before Christmas during the Korean War, and he was at the Los Angeles airport trying to get a ride home to Arizona for Christmas. And he said that a lot of servicemen there and no seats available on the planes. And then a voice came over the loudspeaker and said, any men in uniform wanting a ride to Arizona, go to runway such and such. And they went down there. There was a fellow named Barry Goldwater sitting in his plane. Every day in those weeks before Christmas, all day long, he'd load up the plane, fly it to Arizona, fly them to their homes, fly back over to get another load. During the hectic split-second timing of a campaign, this is a man who took time out to sit beside an old friend who was dying of cancer. His campaign managers were understandably impatient, but he said there aren't many left who care what happens to her. I'd like her to know I care. This is a man who said to his 19-year-old son, there is no foundation like the rock of honesty and fairness. And when you begin to build your life on that rock, with the cement of the faith in God that you have, then you have a real start. This is not a man who could carelessly send other people's sons to war. And that is the issue of this campaign that makes all the other problems I've discussed academic, unless we realize we're in a war that must be won. Those who would trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they have a utopian solution, a peace without victory. They call their policy accommodation. And they say if we'll only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll forget his evil ways and learn to love us. All who oppose them are indicted as warmongers. They say we offer simple answers to complex problems. Well, perhaps there is a simple answer. Not an easy answer, but simple. If you and I have the courage to tell our elected officials that we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right, we cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Now, let's set the record straight. There's no argument over the choice between peace and war. But there's only one guaranteed way you can have peace, and you can have it in the next second. Surrender. Admittedly, there's a risk in any course we follow other than this, but every lesson of history tells us that the greater risk lies in appeasement. And this is the specter our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to face, that their policy of accommodation is appeasement. And it gives no choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. If we continue to accommodate, continue to back and retreat, eventually we have to face the final demand, the ultimatum. And what then? When Nikita Khrushchev has told his people, he knows what our answer will be. He has told them that we're retreating under the pressure of the Cold War, and someday, when the time comes to deliver the final ultimatum, our surrender will be voluntary, because by that time, we will have been weakened from within spiritually, morally, and economically. He believes this because from our side, he's heard voices pleading for peace at any price, or better read than dead. Or as one commentator put it, he'd rather live on his knees than die on his feet. And therein lies the road to war, because those voices don't speak for the rest of us. You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take
the future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain. As free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Hey guys, Scorpio here. Join me every Saturday at 2 p.m. here on Studio A for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, where we discuss the hidden agendas that impact our lives and uncover the secret societies and the shadowy elite who construct the reality that we are supposed to believe. So be there Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, here on Studio A on Revolution Radio, and learn what's really going down.
Lost a little honey on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4am Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
All right, folks. Cannon sent me, not the departed Steve Cannon, but Cannon from the chat sent me a message and asked me the link for the video. So what I played is titled A Time for Choosing by Ronald Reagan. Spoke on the 27th of October, 1964. Stumping for Goldwater. And if you just replace IMO, or in my opinion, as they say on the streets, I don't know what they say on the streets, but if you replace, well, actually, you don't have to. You just got to update the numbers, right? Just got to update the numbers. So I was curious. I know Dr. Fetzer earlier tonight, I just can't call him Jim, was talking about the Rasmussen poll. So I'm at this website, and I don't even really know how legit this website is, but it seems to be a repository of polls. And it's updated. I mean, it's updated as of 7:20 p.m., so it looks like it's updated as of Eastern time. But if you click on that, you can do the poll selection, do all the states. And I'm just going to do all polls in the great state of Minnesota, because that was purple last year. God, see, I don't even believe these numbers. I don't. I was driving through town and I saw about 6 to 7 brave souls standing on the overpass. This was on Sunday with Biden and Harris signs, and I thought, you know, if those were Trump people, the cops would be out. You know, there'd be people screaming at them, but nobody was there. So the way it breaks it down is this way. So I'm looking at, let's just do all polls for the national polls. So they got it broken down this way. Let's just do the presidential general election. And I don't believe polls, but let's just keep it going. So An average of the 2020 presidential general election polls, accounting for each poll's quality, sample size, and recency, they have Biden at 51.8% to 43.4%. And I don't believe any of this. I mean, so they've got a poll from YouGov of 1,363 likely voters. Biden ahead. 1,500 registered voters. Biden ahead. And so it's likely. A stands for adults only. I mean, in every single demographic, I mean, this, it is ridiculous. Redfield Wilton Strategies. They've got, yeah, it's you got some of these polls in double digits, but in every one of these polls, and there are a number of them, the range is from +1 to +12. And I don't believe it's a lot of likely voters. A lot, actually, that's the problem. You have a shit ton, excuse me, of likely voters. Yeah, of the, let's count live on the air. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24 of the 26. Of the 26 N, it's 26, of the 26 polls, and we've got them ranging from October 16th to the 26th to the most recent of October 31st through November 2nd, which is today, and nobody called me. Of the 26, one and two is 3, 5, 7, 8, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 of the 26 polls, of the 26 polls, people, 20, or let's call it 77%, 20 of the 26 polls only polled likely voters. Likely voters. That tells me absolutely nothing. I mean, really, that tells me absolutely nothing. I mean, and the numbers are all over the place. You've got a SurveyMonkey. I mean, come on. So they do a rating here. They do a rating, and this is how they figure out the grade. I just want to see how they determine the grade. Pollster method. So here's the methodology. Or the blueberry pie recipe. So it's live telephone interviews, including cell phones, landline phones, live telephone interviews, interactive voice response, online polls, snail mail service. Okay, the 538 grade, a letter grade from A plus to F that reflects the pollster's predictive plus minus score, or, right? I mean, look, so simply saying if it's 40, if it's 50, 52, if it's 51 to 49% with a plus or minus of 2%, it's essentially a dead heat, right? Pollsters with a relatively small sample of polling now receive a provisional rating rather than a precise letter grade. An AB provisional reading means that the pollster has shown strong initial results. A BC average, CD means below average. So how do they determine? That's what I want to know. How do they determine whether or not it's – so all these polls, with the exception of SurveyMonkey, Rasmussen is only a C+. That gives Biden a plus one. IBD TIPP gives this looks like it's duplicated. Looks like it's duplicated here. Yeah, they got one of these polls. They got Trump as low as 39%. And the Quinnipiac University, it's a B+. As low as 39%. See, I don't. Yeah, I literally believe none of this. Believe none of this. Now, if you look at the U.S. Senate, let's go to Pat. Where do you live? I think Mitch lives in Virginia, right? Right? Okay. So for the U.S. Senate out there, you've got Warner plus 15 over. Do you pronounce it Gade? I don't know what the Virginia race is like. Minnesota, U.S. Senate, Smith over Lewis. Jason Lewis was a congressman from the state, then took a year or so off, and now he's running again. But St. Cloud State University did a poll. Of what was the A again? Age. Yeah, but most of these are just likely voters. Yeah. Now, here's what's interesting. Survey USA, October 16th to the 20th, had literally a dead heat. Then the 17th to the 20th, another poll had Smith plus 11. So it's amazing, these polls. They make no sense. I'm curious to know about... why can't I get What I'm trying to look for is trying to find state. What are you meowing for? What? Can you guys come here? Okay, come here. So Sylvester Charles has this thing where he comes and meows and then sits about. Yeah, I agree, Pat. Yeah, remember in 2016? Oh, who was that pollster for? Was it Fox or something? I forget his name. He tweeted after he did some exit polling where he tweeted something about, I guarantee Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States. And then obviously that didn't happen. And he had to come back and talk about how he was going to do a better job of, you know. But you're right. I think people basically just say, look, let me tell you what I want, what you want to hear. I actually got a call today. I got a call from somebody running for Minnesota, the state senate here in Minnesota, Eric Putnam. Some woman called me, and I told her, I said, look, no, it's not a mouse pad. I said, look, I said, I don't want canned answers that I can easily get on CNN, MSNBC, what have you. And I said, talking about various cities around the state. And apparently Eric Putnam used to be a professor at I think St. Ben's, St. John's, one of the private colleges up here. And, you know, served in the Air Force and married kids, what have you. Talked about how and he wanted to work with St. Cloud or wherever he was from a better place. And I said, okay, well, so I know of the mayor of St. Cloud. So I'm just wondering, since, you know, he wants to, what current relationship does he have? And what is it about St. Cloud that needs to be fixed? Because I've mentioned here, when there was the George Floyd kickoff, they had there's a place in St. Cloud called Lake George. Kind of a public place, kind of by maybe 4 or 5 blocks away from City Hall, kind of a nice little area. They really built the area up by the old historical Tech High School. And there was, I think, one small little incident or something. Otherwise, that was it. St. Cloud PD had a drone fly up, and they were taking aerials. There were no issues. Now, a number of weeks later, we talked about it on this program, when some moron decided to face Facebook Live, he had a weapon or was doing some crazy stuff, I forget the names, and then all of a sudden the police decide, well, we're going to show up at your house now because you've done this twice. And there was a standoff. St. Cloud police showed exceptional testicular fortitude. Nobody was shot. There was a wrestling, and I believe one of the officers was accidentally shot in the hand when they were subduing the suspect. Well, what ended up happening is somebody, some moron, tweeted that St. Cloud had shot one or two St. Cloud officers had shot an unarmed black man or what have you, which resulted in a bunch of dumb shits going down to the police station and to Blair, Chief Blair Anderson's credit, who happens to be a black man, came out and said, okay, get off social media. This is what happened. Came out the next day and just blasted social media. Otherwise, there have been no problems in that city. None whatsoever. So I'm not quite sure what but anyway, my long point is there was a call came in today, but I was talking with somebody, and I got a voicemail message, and it was actually Eric Putnam. But this is what bothered me. The woman said he was going to call me either Saturday night or Sunday. Well, today was Monday. Plus, I went to his website, and it's just sort of the basic, you know, Medicare for all, blah, 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 blah. I'm under open enrollment now, so I can go in there, and I can choose and change my plan. Well, I can tell you right now that my plan will my copay will not increase. I'm under Blue Cross Blue Shield. I have an annual deductible. I am single. I have no dependents. And I'm fine. I did tell you that I know of people who got off, refused the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and said it's actually cheaper for me just to go and buy my own plan. And this is a woman who did have some pre-existing conditions. I mean, she had some reconstructive surgery based on breast cancer and some other stuff. So and I believe she was a voting Democrat. But anyway, so yeah, I'm looking at these numbers and just kind of seeing what we got here. Why? I mean, when people say, why would anybody want to run for public office? I mean, first, you have to have – and this is nothing against anybody, because you have to have a level of narcissism to do that. Now, this is interesting. I just read you the poll. So now we've got this came out earlier today. Senator Tina Smith, Jason Lewis face off in race for Minnesota's closely divided U.S. Senate seat. She's the incumbent. She replaced Al Franken, who resigned because of, you know, some stuff he did in 2017. Smith, a former Planned Parenthood executive, then won the special election in 2018 to serve out Franken's term. Challenger, former Congressman Jason Lewis, worked for years. They spelled conservative wrong. He lost his 2000 bid for re-election to Angie Craig. I want to see if what the numbers indicate. They don't have numbers. They don't have polls. Although there was only two comments. Yeah, they don't have it, but we can check Minnesota's early vote. We can check. Apparently there have been 2,055,519 total absentee ballots requested. So far, there have been 1.7 million accepted, roughly 83.5%. So far, absentee ballots accepted this year are up about 150% from 2016 and 170% from 2018. I mean, you can tell by looking at the counties who voted for Trump and who voted for, I mean, it's just naturally the metropolitan counties of Hennepin, Ramsey. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's how most states go, right? That's how most states go. The largest populous counties end up going for the Democratic incumbent. Olmsted County, which is down in the southern part of the state, but Ramsey and Hennepin are the largest. St. Louis also. Otherwise, you know, some of the suburbs. Otherwise, a majority of the state was Trump, but unfortunately, like most cities, the large metropolitan area of Minneapolis, St. Paul have a lot of people in that's where the numbers are. Here we go. See, it's not giving me what I want. It gives me the same website that I had before, but I don't want that. But then again, I mean, you've got Smith up by five. I don't trust any of these numbers. I really don't. It's unfortunate though, but you know, it is what it is. You can't trust any MFers, as they say. Well, folks. Yeah, they got Biden plus, between plus 3 to plus 5. in Minnesota, but I don't. Then they got electoral maps. See this is just the stupid. This is honestly the dumbest electoral map I've seen. I mean, California's always going to go to Democrats. It doesn't matter. But they've got literally 17. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12 toss-up states. 190 without the toss-up. Biden-Harris 216, Trump-Pence 125, toss-up electoral counts, 197. That math seems wrong. I got solid, likely, leaning. Everything is a toss-up. Yeah, they have Texas a toss-up. Arizona, Nevada, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina toss-up. Michigan Biden leads. Don't buy it. I really don't buy any of this. I really don't buy any of it. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't. But you know what? Let's play the game. Let's pretend. Wednesday morning we wake up. You open up your favorite internet browser and it says Biden is the president. And then you've got George Scarborough, everybody just, you know, going crazy. And I told you so. It'll be dancing in the streets. It'll be dancing in the streets, I tell you. There may be and then within about a month, he'll step down and then Kamala Harris will be the president. But let's just play the game, pretend it happens. Play the game, pretend it happens. Well, there you go. There you go. Well, that's right, Pat. You should assume the gerrymander position. I'll go and vote tomorrow, and we will just see what happens. I mean, you flip between your favorite. It's going to be. I'll tell you. You watch MSNBC with Joe Scarborough in his Mika. I believe she may have had some breast work done. Or CNN tomorrow with Wolf Blitzer, and they're going to be every time a state is called, or NBC, or even the mainstream media, you're going to see people just starting to salivate and get giddy every time a state is called for Biden-Harris. There are people – there. I don't mean to be rude. I don't mean to be rude, but there are literally people – that are going to it's going to be orgasmic for them. I mean, seriously. If it turns away that I think it's going to go this tomorrow, Trump will be reelected. You thought there was craziness 4 years ago. You wait till it's called for Trump. You wait for that. You thought the divorces that took place, you know it, right? There were literally people that divorced their spouses because they had voted for Trump. There were women that literally cut off intimacy with their husbands because they voted for Trump. And I've asked people this. No one's been able to give me a straight answer. And I've said, look, don't give me window dressing. Don't give me sound bites. Give me one specific policy that Trump has enacted that has negatively affected your life, negatively impacted your life. Well, no, I don't know. No, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. Well, because he tweets things you don't like to read? Well, get off Twitter. Because he's a businessman, not a politician? Well, there's no secrets. Yeah, you're right, Pat. It's going to be Canon, that's right. They will scream like little girls. Look, full disclosure, I've told you who I'm voting for. I'm going to say this. Go out and vote. I think that local politics are very, very important. Make sure you address those. Take the time you need between now and the time you vote to cut through all the BS and go out and vote. And I will be tuning in tomorrow because I want to hear what the folks have to say. Otherwise, thanks for listening. We are Revolution Radio, 100% listener supported. Head over to the website. Donate, donate, donate. Otherwise, I will talk with you folks on Thursday, where we will graciously bring back Politis Thursday. Otherwise, have yourself a fabulous evening. Go vote tomorrow. And in the words of Katie Couric, good night, y'all.
Thank you for listening to Revolution.